Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Telecommunications and Electronic Media Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, April 1st, 2014, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group telephone conference call. Today, we'll be discussing the U.S. control of the Internet. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and we're recording today's call for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we're happy to welcome two experts who are going to speak on our topic. I, as always, will only give them brief introductions so we can get to the substance. Their longer bios were provided to you in the notice of today's call and are also available on the Federalist Society's website. We'll hear opening remarks from each in turn of about 6, 8, 10 minutes or so. And as always, we'll be turning to you for your questions after those opening remarks and a little discussion. Patricia J. Paoletta is a partner at Wilshire & Grannis, and the Honorable John M. R. Neuer is president and founder of Neuer LLC. We're going to begin with opening remarks from Ms. Paoletta. Please go right ahead. The floor is yours.
Okay. Thank you, Dean. Okay, as the first speaker, I've been tasked with giving a little overview of what's actually at issue in today's call. So this came about because, as some of you may have noticed, a couple weeks back on a Friday, probably to try to minimize the impact of that news bit, NTIA, which is the National Telecommunications and Information Administration, part of the Department of Commerce, announced that it intends to transition its contract that it currently holds with the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers, which we all know as ICANN, to a different governance structure. And a little background, and John, who actually worked at NTIA during the Bush administration, will provide more background, I'm sure, but the ICANN was created back in 1998 when at the time I was serving as a counsel, so we looked into this and we followed this as this process, you know, developed. When the a few years earlier, the National Science Foundation had transferred the contract to assign numbers and names for internet websites away from a more sort of informal process and try to create, you know, more robust infrastructure for that. So NSF had transferred it to the Department of Commerce. So the House Commerce Committee began looking at it at that point. But at a high brief level, I think most of you know that the Internet started off as a computer network linking different Department of Defense contractors who were involved in research projects. And that, you know, back in the late 60s, and of course it was developed to be distributed and diverse enough that if there were a catastrophic attack on the United States or elsewhere, that, you know, there would be sufficient redundancy that we would have, you know, communications, or the Department of Defense would have communications. So it started off, you know, back in the early days as a government, you know, Department of Defense function to link its researchers. Eventually, over the, you know, decades, it was brought into other research projects beyond just Department of Defense. And of course, then, you know, very early 90s, it was commercialized. And for the adding of new names and numbers to create those websites, originally it was a very informal process just run out of one of the Department of Defense contractors with the University of Southern California's Information Sciences Institute. So it was really a one-man job. One guy, you know, now passed away. John Postel was the, you know, the professor, the IT professor who recorded the names and numbers and kind of assigned that. And as it got more robust and got commercialized, SAIC, which was a, you know, and is a defense contractor, created a subsidiary, Network Solutions. And Network Solutions, which was a private company, began to manage the database of all the assigned names and numbers for the authoritative root zone. So when, you know, when the Internet was commercialized and anybody could sign up, you didn't have to be a Department of Defense or other U.S. government contractor, of course, that got more and more busy, and Network Solutions got fairly wealthy off of that. So when we first started to look at this in you know, the late 90s, when the Department of Defense actually had a public notice for comment to solicit, you know, public input on how this new function should be managed. You know, our concern was, and I think generally was, it certainly the Clinton administration at the time, and of course I was working for Republican Chairman of House Commerce Committee Tom Bliley, was that we do privatize this function because the internet was getting commercialized and we wanted it to be, you know, private and managed by a private entity, but that it be done so in a way that, you know, you had competition in the registration process so that there was competition to network solutions and that there was also stability and transparency. But we always had an interest in having it, of course, be global, because already there was, you know, global interest around the world on the internet, and of course the value of a network is the number of folks using it. But you know, there was always a plan to have this be privatized. Now, of course, in the intervening years, as the internet got more and more popular and more, you know, core to our economic, you know, transactions globally, as well as social media and you know, civil rights and freedom of expression, there was more and more interest in, you know, the governance of the internet. I'm going to let John speak about the governance, but again, back on March 14th, the NTIA announced that it plans to transition its contract that it holds with ICANN away, and that ICANN itself kind of manages. And ICANN has grown over the years, and again, John will address that. But it didn't just say it's going to transition this, or, you know, willy-nilly. It did say ICANN has to go off and come up with a plan, and it will look at it. And it said its approval of any ICANN transition would have to meet, you know, four principles, and that would have, you know, those are that the transition proposal would have to support and enhance multi-stakeholder model, would have to maintain the security, stability, and resiliency of the domain name system, would have to meet the needs and expectations of global customers and partners of that assigned number function, it's the IANA services, and again, maintain the openness of the internet. So there are some core principles NTIA addressed, and it did also note that it will not accept a proposal that replaces NTIA's role, where it has that contract with ICANN, with a government-led or an intergovernmental organization. Now, that was code for the ITU, and I'm going to spend a moment on the ITU, and then I will turn it over to John. But the ITU is an intergovernmental organ. It is an organ of the United Nations, but it actually predates the United Nations. It was founded, you know, in 1865 to deal, you know, 150 years ago, to deal with the new phenomenon then of the telegraph. And it, you know, it does have a legitimate function where governments do need to talk about planning, you know, communications across their borders, whether they're, you know, physical wire, and of course much of the internet is still physical wire. And so the ITU, the International Telecommunications Union, is today alive and well, sitting in Geneva, part of the United Nations. But over the years, as I mentioned, as the internet has become more commercially successful and vital to, you know, almost every function we have, right, the ITU has sought for a role. So for decades, which John can elaborate on, or, you know, decade and a half, they've certainly been pressuring the United States government and the stakeholders for a more direct role in the internet. And we had a huge conference a year and a half at this point in December of 2012, you know, which was the World Communications Conference on International Telecommunications. And that was the main conference goal was, and this is an ITU conference, was to update the international telecommunications regulations, which, of course, were written in an era before the internet was commercialized. You know, last updated in 1988, you know, the folks at DARPA and the other Department of Defense and other researchers were certainly using what was the internet, but it had not yet been commercialized. So there were many folks involved in that discussion, including, you know, folks who are not known for their human rights, including Russia, Saudi Arabia, Iran, China, that wanted to revise the international telecommunications regulations to provide a more central role of the ITU in that, you know, critical IANA function. So there was a track record at the ITU of seeking to have more of a role in the, you know, of internet governance. And the U.S. working with its partners in Europe and the more democratized, you know, and market-driven economies in Asia, you know, to push back on actually revising the ITRs to provide a central role for the ITU. But, you know, that's certainly in the background, and I think that inspired a lot of the reaction that we had, particularly from Republicans on the Hill, both the Senate and the House, you know, to react the way they did with the NTIA's announcement. So I think I'll leave it at there, and then later on we can talk about the various Republican responses we've seen today with, you know, with bills proposed and hearings. But at this point, I'll stop and let John take over.
Thanks, Tricia. That was a very good historical background. I'm going to try and bring this forward a little bit to where we are, and I know this is a call primarily for lawyers, and I apologize if I diverge into the technical a little bit, but I'm going to be diverging into the technical as a lawyer, so have no fear that we get deep into the engineering. But this really is an issue where issues of technology and law and global public policy come into intersection. And because you've got these disparate disciplines all converging in the same place, I think there is often an opportunity for lack of clarity and misunderstanding. And sometimes those misunderstandings are intentionally leveraged by people who have one level of policy objective or another, and sometimes they just muddy the waters a little bit, and I'll try and explain what I'm talking about. So as Tricia discussed, the legal underpinnings of these relationships came out of the operational change of the internet from this DARPA-led science project, for lack of a better word, to the global network that it represents today, or the interconnection of global networks that it represents today. Once the decision was made to open the internet to non-federal users, that's when, as Tricia said, the decision was made to move the management of the domain name system into the Commerce Department. And as the growth of the internet accelerated through a series of consultations, the internet historians will reference the green paper and the white paper and the final decision to create NewCo, which became ICANN, to manage what are called the IANA functions. These are very technical functions that pull together all of the disparate operational pieces that are required to manage the domain name system. The domain name system is, you know, to think of it in simple terms, is the phone book cross-reference for the internet. Computers only recognize IP addresses, and human beings need to have keys to things like federalistsociety.org. A 16-digit or 32-digit string of numbers doesn't help us. So at its most basic, that's what we're talking about. These core IANA functions, which are highly technical in nature, do not lend themselves to policy inputs. You know, they should be dispassionate and technically led. And there are different global institutions that have inputs into the IANA. So, for example, there is a group called Regional Internet Registries, who have the responsibility for distributing bulks of IP addresses within their countries. IP addresses that are being handed out then have to be coordinated with the root zone file. So there is the authoritative root zone that needs to update the phone book, for lack of a better word. And there needs to be a central place and a central function to coordinate these. And collectively, that's what we refer to as the IANA function. So when we decided to move that out of the United States government and put it into the hands of the private sector, a new entity was created, and that is ICANN. And the contracts with ICANN have been in different forms. There is the IANA contract itself, which is essentially what they call a cooperative research and development agreement between the United States government and a private entity, ICANN. But there have also been a series of memorandums of understandings and contracts where the U.S. government held a stewardship role to try to make sure that this new co, ICANN, which was going to hold this key function, was actually institutionalized in a way that we could be confident that they could perform this key function. And that took a variety of different milestones. So they would need to demonstrate that they had the support of the constituencies that they were supposed to be serving, those who perform the sub-functions of the IANA, the internet community at large, domestically and globally, the registries, which are the database managers for each of the top-level domains. So .com has a registry associated with it. .net and .org, .org has a different registry associated with it. Then there are all of the country codes have different registries or different management contracts. So .fr for France is managed by a registry. All of the new generic top-level domains that are out there that are being released that we've been in the news a great deal, each of those will have their own registry. So we need to make sure that ICANN had support of those entities. For example, the registrars, which can register, they're sort of the retailer. So GoDaddy and TwoCows and all of these other companies out there that you go to register your domain. All there are a lot of different moving pieces across the internet ecosystem and marketplace. And we wanted to make sure that ICANN had the support of those entities, that it actually had a corporate governance structure that was accountable, that it had finances, that it had a legal identity. It was all these sorts of basic institution building criteria that we wanted to make sure that ICANN had in place before we totally stood back as the U.S. government and said, you know, we don't need to perform this stewardship role. And so those series of agreements, there was the first statement of policy in 1998, then there was an MOU. When I was at NTIA in Commerce, we executed something called the Joint Project Agreement, the JPA, which we signed in 2006, which created a number of milestones. And from its inception, that was kind of the role that the U.S. government had with regard to ICANN, a role of stewardship and standing up and making sure that it was in place. But throughout that entire time, our role with regards to the IANA functions was simply one of technical oversight. There was never a time that we ever made any decisions with regards to how the IANA function should be performed, where we second-guessed the technical decisions of those in place. So when people talk about, and this is where the intersection of sort of law and policy and technology comes together, different observers have looked at our role with ICANN, where we're creating milestones for them with regards to accountability and transparency and security and those sorts of things that we needed to make sure that this was a functioning institution. And they sort of conflated that with the technical functions of IANA. And to the extent that we had our, you know, quote-unquote control around IANA, I think the way to think of it is it was a function of negative control. By the function that we were there, no other entity or institution could step in and try and manipulate these technical functions of IANA in service to competitive or parochial or geopolitical concerns. And part of our managing this transition, while we were creating, getting ICANN to be institutionalized, you know, people who wanted government agencies to or government entities to have a greater ability to reach into those technical functions in the service of, like I said, competitive or geopolitical concerns, started getting much more active in the international forums that Tricia described, the ITU, There have been a couple of unique standalone UN summits that have been pulled together to talk about the internet. And this became a new sort of threat vector to the successful private sector management of the internet. While we initially were concerned simply about institutionalizing of ICANN, as time went on, we became more and more concerned about the ambitions of others in the international community who really wanted to change the private sector-led multi-stakeholder approach of ICANN and move it more into an intergovernmental kind of function. So where we've gotten to now, and I think what the last announcement by Commerce reflects is an understanding, or at least an attempt to manage this dynamic, whereby the fact that the U.S. government is continuing to maintain this oversight at some level starts to play into the hands of those who want more governmental control. So the sooner that we can say this doesn't require any governmental control and really represent that by eliminating our vestigial oversight, I think that undermines the arguments of those in the international community that says, you know, if one government is involved, all governments need to be involved. I think the challenge for us, though, in getting through this process that Commerce has launched is underscoring exactly what it was we were doing in the past, which was, you know, I've come to think of it as this negative control, that by us being there, nobody else can come in and manipulate these technical decisions. I think whatever the new institutional structure is going to have to be robustly tested to make sure that once we step away, that there is no ability for anybody else to come in and interfere. So whether it is a pure automation or there is some sort of poison pill or default hatch that says, you know, the IANA has moved into an automated, purely technical, privately managed function. And if it ever is pulled out of that, then, you know, IANA default somewhere. I mean, that's purely speculation, but trying to capture when you replace the USG, it's going to have to be, we stood as a bulwark against intergovernmental interference. Whatever replaces us is going to have to demonstrate that it is a sufficiently robust bulwark against that intergovernmental meddling and interference. And I think I'll leave it there for my opening remarks, and certainly happy to engage the call with questions.
Well, thank you very much, both of you. We're going to open the floor to questions. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After that, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for either of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got a few people on the phone. We've got one caller question at this point. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let me take a brief pause here to announce our call tomorrow, Thursday at noon, our teleforum conference call. We'll be discussing the state AG's role in enforcing and defending state laws. That's Thursday at 12 noon Eastern Time. Today we're talking about control of the internet. Let me start us off here by asking if you want to say more about the impetus here. What's the push for change? The internet, I think a lot of people are concerned because it's one of the real growth areas, even in a stubborn or stagnant economy. It's been a real success story. Why not just stick with the status quo? What's the impetus for change?
Well, and I'll jump in, and I know John has a lot to say on this as well. As he can attest, there has been, you know, a good decade worth of pressure from other governments who want more of a role. And as John said, because the U.S. government had a role, they felt as, you know, more and more of their economic activity moves, you know, online, and you know, they too want a role. But I'd say the, you know, and we did just have a bruising battle at the Wicket in December 2012 to keep those folks, you know, those, you know, primarily the BRICS and some of the Middle Eastern countries who obviously are proponents of censoring their, you know, the freedom of speech. So we just had this bruising battle, but the revelations of NSA spying by Snowden, I think that was kind of the straw that broke the camel's back, and they've, you know, and the administration has been on its heels ever since in terms of internet policy when they're dealing with, you know, global policy issues in these international fora. So I think this was kind of a bone to throw to the international community because, you know, they weren't going to win yet another debate on this in light of those revelations. Now, you know, the folks on this call obviously can differentiate between, you know, NSA surveillance, which would happen whether or not the, you know, authoritative root zone server A is in the United States or otherwise. But, you know, it's the U.S. administration has been playing defense so much on the NSA revelations that, and, you know, and everything else that was leaked by Snowden, that I think they just felt this was a way to buy them some peace. So I think that was kind of the event that broke the dam.
No, I think that's right, and I think that was reflected in recent announcements by some of our, trading partners who had supported us in earlier intergovernmental forums on this issue. You know, just a few months ago, and it was explicitly linked to the Snowden events. The EU indicated that they would no longer support the status quo in terms of the U.S. ICANN, IANA relationships. And without that, I think it became clear that we would not be able to carry the day at another intergovernmental forum, whether it was at the ITU plenipotentiary or some independently sponsored UN forum where this question was raised, we wouldn't have the support to defend the status quo. So at that point, I think the best case has to be, you know, having this question asked and answered before you get to the next ITU. The plenipotentiary is coming up when, Tricia? The next?
It's in the fall, October.
October this year.
So it's imminent.
So you really wanted to be able to take the wind out of those sails to say, you know, you're now trying to solve for something that doesn't exist. But all of that as prelude, now the hard work begins to make sure that however we conclude this, whatever whatever institutional framework the IATA functions transition to, they're going to have to be able to demonstrate the same ability to stave off calls for intergovernmental interference that the USG has been able to conduct in its role. So that's going to be an organizational, institutional challenge, and it's going to take, you know, the support of those entities and institutions in the private sector and those who have supported us in the past and our, you know, democratic industrialized trading partners to help build up that framework in such a way that we can move forward without having the, you know, the future openness of the internet, you know, called into question.
And to just, if I may, Dean.
Please go ahead.
Just to give an example of, you know, what we're talking about. You know, we're all familiar with the high level generic TLDs, the top level domains like .gov, .com, .edu. Recently, and this was an ICANN decision which Commerce Department, you know, accepted. Recently, there was an agreement that we could expand, or we, you know, the ICANN community, the internet ecosystem, could expand the number of top level domains. But those that expansion has to be approved by ICANN, and today there is a government advisory to ICANN, and you know that again that wasn't in the initial vision in 1998, but again with additional government's interest, so that you know they were supposed to have more of a hortatory, you know, advisory role, and it is so broad, you know, there's 100 and plus governments already represented on that, on that, what's called the GAC, the Government Advisory Committee, that, you know, but they have expressed views on you know, additional GLDs. So, for instance, you know, somebody had a proposal to have .Indians as a TLD, and the Indian government opposed that. And now in the United States, you know, we wouldn't, you know, we might not like it, we would let that go forward. But, I mean, that's an example of where, or you could have, you know, a website where Syrian, you know, rebels want to have, you know, something, something dot free. And again, if a ICANN that is government-led and a governance that allows individual governments to say, no, you can't give them that website, you can't create that website, you know, because obviously within their own country, they can stop traffic going to a website, but they couldn't prevent a website where the database is in the United States or in Europe from creating, you know, a website for, you know, rebels or protesters in the site. But if a government-led ICANN has the power to stop the names of websites, obviously you can see the impact on freedom of speech. So that's, you know, when we talk about the openness of the of the internet and freedom of speech, that's what we're talking about, the actual names of database, and of course how people get there and can, you know, find the authoritative database for that is obviously, you know, it's a technical process that John's alluding to, but it's the freedom of speech and ability to assemble and, you know, political dissidents that we're talking about here, and that could be thwarted if the governments can actually say, no, don't create that new website.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We have just one question pending. Let's go to our first caller.
Hello, this is Stuart Gerson. This is an issue that I've been following closely, and the last speaker, I think, went to the nut of it. I mean, we learned about the abuses in Burma, Myanmar, via the internet. The Arab Spring was fomented by the internet. How, if we as a nation, the United States, lacks the leverage to perpetuate our own role with ICANN, can we remotely expect to carry the day with regard to the successor organization, which is more likely to be some product, say, of the United Nations, where two of the five members of the Security Council or China and Russia are among the strongest proponents of censoring the internet, or with respect to Europe, where France is dead set against us? Exactly how is it that we could bring about what you properly expressed in a hortatory way, which is a successor that would operate the ICANN functions in the technical nonpartisan way that the United States has been doing?
Well, I think I hear you making a presumption that there will be a new institution other than ICANN. That's not how I would anticipate this to roll out. So, as I said, part of what we did for a long time of our oversight role was institutional oversight and guidance of ICANN to make sure that it was a robust institution that had the support of the entities and the constituencies that collectively make up the internet community. And I think ICANN has gone a very long way to getting there. So and in a very real way, from a legal sense, even though there are contracts that tie certain institutions together, at its core, all of this is a consensus-based organization. If at any time during our oversight, which we, you know, we still maintain, if the United States government had ever tried to take its contractual authority and reach into the authoritative root zone and start handpicking and pulling out, you know, keys to the roadmap, you know, we don't want, you know, people to be able to get to jihadist websites. So we're just going to reach into the root zone and pull those guys out of the internet. If we have ever in any sort of active way tried to take advantage of our authority, which is why I described our control as sort of negative control, we sat there in that breach but didn't exert any authority. If we'd ever tried to do that, I think the system would have collapsed and people would have just, you know, en masse turned away from the existing authoritative roots and told them, look somewhere else, look to a new institution for the roots. This again is where the technical, you know, intersects with policy and law. But essentially the authoritative root zone that gets updated through coordination with ICANN and then delivery to VeriSign for the upgrade of the authoritative root is just a snapshot in time of the internet. And that authoritative root then gets recast in 12 other root zones around the world. But each one of those is mirrored by companies and institutions and colleges and think tanks, and there are hundreds of them all over the world. The only reason the coordinating function, at its most elemental, the reason it resides within ICANN and the reason these things work is because the community agrees to let it stay there. So that threshold in and of itself is a huge barrier against the kind of, you know, rapid precipitous transition that I think you're rightly concerned of, where suddenly, you know, even some of our closest trading partners and geopolitical allies have very different concepts of speech, for example, than we do in the United States. There's whole classes of speech that in America we consider abhorrent, but equally consider protected. And, you know, some of our European allies don't share those sorts of views. There can be speech they think it's offensive enough, they'll take action to ban it. So I don't think that what we're facing is that precipitous kind of a change. And the primary, you know, defense against that precipitous change is that we have built up ICANN as the institution over the past 20 years, that all of these stakeholders have now invested in and agree that these are where these functions are going to take place. The challenge is going to be, you know, to have some sorts of triggers to make sure that when it comes to the core technical IANA functions, that the standard of negative control remains the status quo, that those functions can't be performed except for through the existing technical work coordination bodies, and, you know, that intergovernmental interference will by definition, you know, invalidate any changes. I'm not sure what the details of that structure are going to be, but that's what we're going to have to get to. That's going to be the key piece that puts up this barrier. But I don't believe that we have opened up the vacuum that your question seems to be concerned with.
Patricia Paoletto, did you want to weigh in here?
Well, I may have a little more concern than John did, because I think that right now we have some protection in that the authoritative root zone does physically sit in Virginia. It's within the United States. And in fact, there's been a number of censuses of Congress over the years, both on the House side and the Senate, that root zone, should the authoritative root zone file, should stay physically in the United States. Doesn't have to be in Virginia, but depends probably who the chair of the Commerce committees are at the time. But that it should certainly be within the physical jurisdiction of the United States. And, you know, currently ICANN is a private sector company that was incorporated in California, so it's a U.S. corporation by incorporation. And that was a historical accident of, again, John Postel of the University of Southern California sitting there. But ICANN already, as John kind of alluded to, it is already very internationalized. The current president is an Egyptian. by birth and well, raised maybe in Lebanon, but, you know, worked for IBM. So he's not with the, you know, Egyptian Ministry of, you know, Suppression or anything, but, you know, so it's already very international. So, but I do have some concern that if the Department of Commerce was to, in fact, let that contract lapse with ICANN, even though it is more, you know, or to date has been largely rubber stamping changes to the root zone that ICANN has decided to pursue on its own, that we could lose control of that physical, you know, relationship, right? That ICANN could reincorporate in, you know, whatever country it wanted to, because it is, you already have a lot of provocateurs and advocates within the ICANN board and corporation, as well as, you know, the certainly on the government advisory committee, that want ICANN out of the United States or want it more dispersed. So I'm a little more worried about this, perhaps.
No, and I think, you know, I think those are all good points, and I think those are the kind of indicia that we're going to want to see. When I was talking about, you know, what are the bulwarks that we're going to put up, you know, that it's got to be a privately incorporated, you know, entity. That this can't be. This needs to be, you know, incorporated in. Make it the laws of the state of California. Leave it where it is. But those are the kinds of things that I think not just the Commerce Department is going to have to require before this transition is completed, but again, making, you know, the broad range of stakeholders understand that these are the key things that need to be in place, and building that multi-stakeholder, you know, and I tended to tire of some of the, you know, the platitudes about, you know, multi-stakeholder, private sector, bottom-up, consensus-driven. There are all these catchphrases in ICANN land that one learns to spout out, you know, on cue, but they also reflect, you know, some core agreements that we need to make sure are kept in place. So I'm not, if I left the impression I'm sanguine that based on everything that was announced a couple of weeks ago, that everything is going to be fine, that's not the impression I wanted to leave. Based on the announcement from a couple of weeks ago, there are going to be continued threat vectors, and we're going to have a great deal of hard work in front of us to make sure that whatever the ultimate transition state looks like, that we have defended against, you know, the known you know, threats that are out there.
Well, it's going to be a question. I'm sorry, Patricia, go right ahead.
Okay, well, I was just going to say that even President Clinton actually noted that we say multi-stakeholder, but we have to be honest with ourselves that, you know, many of those multi-stakeholders are governments. So they're, you know, there's, as you suggested, right, there's an agenda with some of those multi-stakeholders. And, you know, I thought for this group's consumption, yeah, President Clinton has criticized the proposal, and I think in part this is some of his trying to differentiate his, you know, wife, who was Secretary, obviously, of State under this administration, but for her run for the presidency. But one of her main policy goals and or sort of signature speeches and legacies at the State Department was her Internet freedom speech. So, and, you know, of course, the tale of the Arab Spring has been well, we've had to retell it as events have unfolded there, but she's been very rightfully proud of her support of Internet freedom. So I think we're seeing some of those presidential politics at play. But anyway, as John said, it does raise concerns. One of my concerns is that, I mean, you could, as a legal approach, say, okay, well, we're going to move more towards privatization, let ICANN, all grown up, you know, as a private corporation, do its own thing, but we're going to require that it stays in California. But even that obviously violates some principles of limited government and you know, and liquidity and corporate freedom. So it's, you know, the shame is that this current contract, as benign as it is, given, you know, Department of Commerce's minimal roles under it, you know, at least had a kind of an elegance that didn't require us to do more, you know, regulatory solutions, like, you know, again, requiring people to stay in certain jurisdictions.
We've got one more question pending. If you want to join the queue, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's take another question.
Yes, so thanks for the comments so far. Great presentation. It's inevitable that any organization, just given sufficient time, will be subject to some kind of either deterioration or some kind of capture, some kind of internal problems, which, unless there's an active mechanism for monitoring those, an external mechanism for monitoring those and reacting to them, is likely going to lead to a very much different type of ICANN than what we see today. My question has to do with, I think one of the speakers actually mentioned the word triggers. What kind of active monitoring of the successor to ICANN do you envision? And then what types of triggers do you expect? What kind of thresholds, hard thresholds, would result in what types of actions should ICANN start developing into a gone bad organization, either through being captured by other interests or even just internally for an organization that becomes bloated, full of largesse, nepotism, the types of things we've seen in the United Nations?
Right. So I think, you know, taking your question, you know, as you presented it, that this is not an ICANN-centric issue, this is a concern of institutions, that they change, they get captured, they get bloated, whatever it may be. You know, as part of this ultimate transition period, I think that, you know, there shouldn't be a limit on the kinds of things that we look to with regards to ICANN. If that means, you know, reexamining its board structure, examining its corporate governance. You know, Tricia made the point, not all stakeholders are, quote unquote, created equally. When it comes to the technical functions, there are, known groups that collectively represent the IANA. So there's the Internet Engineering Task Force, which is responsible for coordinating changes to the Internet protocols. Should they have as loud a voice, a louder voice, or a less loud voice than, you know, something that something like the Government Advisory Committee, or, you know, the amorphously named, you know, user community. I don't know who that is, but, you know, the IETF, the task force, to my mind, when it comes to technical decisions, ought to have a louder voice, or at least for issues of IANA, you need to make sure that these technical decisions are isolated. So, you know, I think it is part of the human condition that human-created institutions are subject to the kinds of changes over time that you caution against. I don't know that we can create a structure to completely immunize them from those sorts of things. But I do think, so long as, you know, for example, it could be as simple as, you know, defining and delineating what classes of organizations and people are permitted to have a say in the technical decisions, in the IANA functions. And if governments are explicitly excluded from that, but that's also what I meant by that we've got hard work in front of us to make sure that this transition concludes, you know, frankly, better than it launched, where there was, you know, lots of concern and worry. And I think concerns and worries were all absolutely rightly founded, because we did seem to leave a lot of unanswered questions with regards to how this was ultimately going to conclude. And that may just be the nature of the the multi-stakeholder process that, that this is going to go through, that we can't, you know, we wanted to, you know, avoid being perceived as dictating outcomes, although, frankly, I would have preferred that we were at least stronger in defining, you know, what in fact was going to be acceptable and what was not. They did some of that in their four, you know, milestones that they laid out. But, you know, I don't have the complete list of what the triggers and things are going to be, but, you know, we're going to the basic guideposts of keeping governments from interfering, I think, is well understood. The challenge now will be to how do we structure it to give us the max amount of confidence that, you know, it doesn't get there. And, you know, I'm running on, but just to conclude on that piece, the existence of the IANA contract was not an absolute fail-safe to the governments getting involved despite that contract. You know, I think where a lot some of this came from, and, you know, it is misdirection and unrelated, but for good or ill, the Snowden episode really weakened our hand with our international trading partners. And if we don't figure out something now, we could very well find ourselves just on the losing end of a UN resolution 5 years from now where this is simply taken. So that's another threat that we have to avoid. Not that it stumbles into the hands of the international community, but building a structure so that we just don't flat out lose and it gets taken.
Patricia Paoletta, did you want to jump in here?
Yeah, well, I agree with most of that. What I've been thinking, and I have no client in this fight, I suppose, but, you know, that once the Department of Commerce said that they plan to transition the contract and or basically let it lapse and let ICANN do it without having changes to the root zone file be approved by Department of Commerce, I mean, it's going to be very difficult to back off of that. But what we've seen over the years has been when, you know, issues have percolated that are politically sensitive, Congress has gotten involved and they've passed resolutions like they did going into the wicket, which, you know, were hopefully helpful to the U.S. delegates from state and other, you know, and Commerce and others, you know, to say, no, we can't accept this. But so I think we are going to have to have a new structure, but in my view, it's got to maintain ICANN as a U.S. corporation, and again, with the root zone file in the United States. Now, and again, that's already the law or the policy of the land. Both the House and the Senate have passed resolutions to that effect. But, you know, I think this is going to be, you know, a process where Commerce Department will not just do whatever it wants unilaterally. You have both House and Senate looking at this, certainly the House. I mean, the House is going to have a hearing. The Energy and Commerce Committee is having a hearing tomorrow. I think House Judiciary is also having a hearing. So these issues are going to be discussed. We'll have lots of folks weighing in, and, you know, how do you actually structure this? But I think it's going to be critical to, you know, if we replace the IANA contract, we're going to have to replace it with some other legal framework where the United States has oversight over this. You know, despite the blowback we will inevitably get internationally. And I would just add the ICANN had a meeting and the Government Advisory Committee had a meeting last week on this, and they issued a communique, you know, stating their points on this and that and the other thing. But included in that communique is that, you know, they're looking forward to the next meeting of ICANN and GAC, and they're looking forward on ways to enhance the role of governments in the ICANN model and the future role of GAC, which I think is code for, you know, making the GAC more of a policy-making machine as opposed to just, you know, an advisory entity that, you know, doesn't have decision-making functionality. So, you know, that we've already seen a reaction internationally to NTIA's announcements, and, you know, and they're getting bolder. So I say we do have to keep an eye on this, and hopefully there will be congressional oversight and some suggestions. And you know, Commerce did this. I think the timing was because of all the you know, as we've already discussed, all the pressure they're getting from, you know, the Snowden release, certainly the, you know, the wicket, the upcoming Honeypot. I mean, there's a lot of pressure on them. So I think they did it early, and who knows? They may have done it as a, you know, a cry from the heart to get, you know, Congress to give them again another mandate that, sorry, community, we'd like to, you know, share the, you know, keys to the kingdom, but our Congress just won't let us do it. So, you know, I think there may have been some of that because, again, the contract itself does not lapse till September 2015. So we have time to develop a, you know, a new governance model that both, you know, keeps the government of the United States, which has a First Amendment, you know, with the primacy of oversight, but also, you know, addresses some of the, you know, can be somewhat of a safety valve and some of the other concerns that have been, you know, building over the years in terms of distributing the governance responsibility. But one other point, it's, I think the caller, the question came at, he mentioned that ICANN is so bloated, and, you know, and that is one of the problems. They are very rich now. The ICANN is a corporation that has a lot of money from, you know, the payments they get for registration of websites, and those are, you know, annual payments. So, you know, they have a lot of money to pay off people who might disagree with a more U.S.-centric role, or not a more U.S.-centric role, but a revised governance model that keeps the U.S. government kind of as the primary overseer. So, I mean, that's a concern, too. So if you let ICANN go off and do its own thing, you know, that is a concern, that the folks who have a different vision in mind and who are more close to repressive regimes, you know, could very well influence that outcome. So it's definitely an area of concern. And from my perspective, we need a lot of congressional involvement in this to make sure that commerce doesn't do this in a vacuum, because it's tough being in the United States, as John can attest. It's very difficult being in the United States at an ITU conference where you're very much outnumbered, and particularly when, because of the Snowden events, you know, you have our closest group of countries, the European Union, not working with us.
Final thought from John Neuer?
Just that, you know, as Tricia said, we've got time. The contract doesn't expire until 2015. In my experience, you know, these things have, you know, can extend for short periods of time, potentially. But I do think that given the announcement that we made and given the reaction of the world community to it, it will be extraordinarily difficult for us to do anything other than to, you know, endorse some new structure between now and 2015. And that's now the challenge for, you know, those of us who understand the U.S. role for what it has been, understand the dangers of a change from a private sector model to one that's intergovernmental. So it's going to require, you know, considerable thinking from lawyers like those who are on this call and from people who have a stake in the open internet to make sure that we are pulling towards creating that structure that's going to, you know, keep the status quo as private sector led and free of government interference while we transition from the status quo of the U.S. government's, you know, negative control stewardship role.
Well, we are just about out of time. I want to give my thanks on behalf of the Federalist Society to John Neuer and Patricia Paoletta for joining us today. To our audience, thank you for dialing in and for your participation here today. A reminder that Thursday at 12 noon Eastern Time, we'll be discussing the role of the state AGs in enforcing and defending state laws. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.